Israel Berry's Ariel Sharon. Today, January 13th, this is the world. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, remembering the man who some say earned his nickname, the Bulldozer.
Ariel Sharon saw an objective, and he would just drive right at that objective and sometimes drive right through that objective.
Also, keeping America's Olympic athletes safe in Sochi, I asked the CEO of one private security company involved if his employees will be carrying weapons.
We don't comment on typically the tools of the trade that might get used, but in this particular instance with Russia, there are going to be plenty of guns in the hands of the Russians themselves, so there's no need for us to do that.
Oddly, not so comforting. Plus, how Belgium is preparing for an influx of tourists on the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Love him or hate him, Israel buried one of its greats today. Ariel Sharon died over the weekend at the age of 85. He'd spent the last 8 years in a coma following a stroke. Sharon was known as a decisive military leader, but his legacy includes a seemingly big political turnaround. After years of helping Jewish settlers move into the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip and West Bank, Sharon pulled the Israeli military and 8,000 Jewish settlers out of Gaza. Jeffrey Goldberg, columnist with Bloomberg View, says that wasn't really a reversal for Sharon.
He had one goal, which was to maximize Israel's security, and he would do anything to maximize Israel's security, including invading Lebanon all the way up to Beirut, as many people recall. This was of a piece with everything that he had done. What changed was he absorbed reality, realized that 8,000 settlers against 1.5 million Palestinians wasn't a good percentage, and simply pulled them back. It was not an indication that he was becoming a quote-unquote peacenik, you know, as other prime ministers have done, Ehud Olmert, Ehud Barak. He did not do this by negotiating with the Palestinians. Nothing in his views of the Palestinians changed. He just thought Israel would be safer if these particular set of Jews were out of the Gaza Strip. And so he moved them around like he was playing chess in some ways.
Yeah, change of tactic.
Just a change of tactics. This was not strategic, new strategic understanding.
But why was it so hard for people at the time to understand that?
Well, most people did understand it. The truth is that it went very well. The overwhelming majority of Israelis backed it. Most Israelis looked at those settlers in Gaza as if they were crazy. There was a lot of opposition, obviously, from the settlers and their supporters, but it actually went remarkably smoothly. It didn't go well in his political party, the Likud party, so he broke off and just formed a new party. I mean, it was very interesting to watch a man of action, especially when you compare him to the current prime minister, who was not precisely a man of action. Ariel Sharon saw an objective, and he would just drive right at that objective and sometimes drive right through that objective.
Now, there is some evidence today presented in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, that Sharon wanted to pull more settlers out of the West Bank as well.
Yep.
You've written that Israel might have done that if Sharon hadn't suffered a stroke.
Yep.
How much do you think Sharon's plan, his reversal, if you will, weighs on Israel's current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
Look, the West Bank is harder than Gaza. Gaza is an alien concept in sort of Jewish history to the Jewish state. It's where Samson went and pulled down the temple. It's not a place associated with happy Jewish experiences. The West Bank is the heartland of the Jewish people. It's where Judaism started. And so obviously that becomes a much more complicated matter for any Israeli prime minister. But I don't think that their understanding of the problem differs. You know, they're trying to protect Israel as a Jewish majority haven and a democracy, and you can't have both of those things if you have Arabs on the West Bank who don't have citizenship and don't have their own state. And I don't think Netanyahu misunderstands that essential dilemma. I'm certain that John Kerry, among others, has pounded that reality into his head. The real question is Netanyahu a strong enough leader to pull that off? You had in Yitzhak Rabin and Ariel Sharon in particular, really, really strong leaders with a lot of credibility and a reputation for toughness, and they could sell the Israeli public on difficult ideas. It's not clear that Netanyahu can sell the same.
Well, one of the reasons these guys had a reputation for toughness is because they were tough, right?
They were tough.
They proved themselves on the battlefield long before they became parliamentarians or prime ministers. The question for you, Jeffrey Goldberg, what happens now? Israel's, general statesmen, soldier statesmen are gone.
Yeah, that age of larger-than-life leaders seems to be over, but someone is going to have to step up. I have a theory of Israeli leadership throughout history, and there are three seats in the Israeli, or the Zionist pantheon, if you will. The first is occupied by Theodor Herzl, who dreamt up the idea of a return to Zion for the Jewish people. The second is David Ben-Gurion, who made concrete that vision, who founded the state. And the third seat is still empty. It's the person who will define once and for all Israel's borders, who will build peaceful relations with Israel's neighbors, who will get Israel the permanence and stability that it has sought for 66 years. That was going to be Rabin, but he was assassinated. It was going to be Sharon, but he was filled by a stroke. And so that seat is open, and it's going to take, obviously, somebody with enormous capacity for leadership to figure this out.
Jeffrey Goldberg, Bloomberg View columnist, still waiting for the Messiah.
As ever.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ariel Sharon's burial today was, of course, a solemn and formal occasion, which is funny because Sharon is remembered in Israel as a man who disliked formalities. He's also said to have had a good sense of humor. And so for some reflection on the life of Ariel Sharon, reporter Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv checked in with a leading Israeli caricaturist whose job it was to portray Sharon.
One of the things caricaturist Amos Biederman misses most about drawing Ariel Sharon is his smile. When Sharon smiled, Biederman says,
you see his eyes also, and you know already that he's plotting something.
A glint in his eye, you could say.
Yeah, a glinting in his eyes.
And Sharon did have a lot of surprises in store throughout the last chapters in his career, and Biederman drew them all. Biederman is a caricaturist for Israel's leading liberal daily Haaretz. One of his earlier caricatures of Sharon was when he was elected prime minister in 2001.
This drawing that I'm showing to you here, it was his victory in the election. So I draw him as a DJ in a party with all the Likud members around.
In that caricature, Biederman portrays Sharon, known almost universally by his nickname Arik, with a toothy grin, a sparkle in his eyes, and a very large body.
He looks here like the governor of New Jersey. What's his name? Christie. He's fat. It's a fun to draw. He is a present for illustrators. We have to only make the balloon with a small line for white hair. And we have Eric Sharon.
Biederman calls himself a liberal hawk. He never voted for Sharon, but he had a lot of admiration for him. Biederman fought in Israel's Yom Kippur War of 1973 in an artillery regiment connected to Major General Ariel Sharon's brigade.
And in the evening, we used to listen to Ariel Sharon in the radio talking to his commander in the field. And we gained a lot of power out of this conversation. He was always cool, always give compliments to the people in the field, never give them a hard time. It was quite an experience.
Biederman says Sharon made a huge mistake as defense minister during the 1982 Lebanon War. He was held indirectly responsible for a massacre of Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. Sharon also pummeled the Palestinian territories in response to Palestinian bombings in Israel in the early 2000s. Biederman praises Sharon for his heavy hand in eventually stopping those Palestinian attacks, and also for his surprising and dramatic order for all Israeli settlers to leave the Gaza Strip.
Nobody else in Israel, even if they want to do it, could do it. He used his extreme charisma, his extreme power, and he did it like that.
Biederman says he's sad to see Sharon go, but he's happy Secretary of State John Kerry's been visiting a lot lately, trying to bring peace.
He have a huge hair, a big jaw. It's very fun, yeah. I wish him good luck, and I hope he will stay here around for a long time. It's very fun to draw him.
For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv.
Remembering Sharon in cartoon form, we have a slideshow of Amos Biederman's work at PRI.org. It's almost crunch time for anybody preparing for the Winter Olympics next month in Sochi. That goes for athletes as well as security personnel. These Olympics are taking place in Russia's volatile Caucasus region, and last summer an Al-Qaeda-linked group there called on its supporters to disrupt the Olympics. Then there were those two suicide bombings last month in the southern Russian city of Volgograd. Last week, the Russian government started to impose a police lockdown on Sochi to keep any trouble out of the Olympic venues. But some participants have backup plans. The U.S. ski and snowboard teams have hired a Boston-based company called Global Rescue to be on hand to help in case of emergency. Dan Richards is the CEO of Global Rescue, and he's here with me in the studio. Tell me, Dan, what exactly have you been hired to do?
So Global Rescue's had a relationship with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association for about the last 8 years. And what we provide are crisis management, response, and contingency planning in addition to the actual mechanism of evacuation should an evacuation be required. And we typically respond to really two types of emergencies, medically oriented emergencies and security oriented emergencies, and sometimes both.
So can you be specific about some things you're thinking about now that you didn't have to in Turin, Italy?
Well, you don't have in some of these other competitions individuals who have committed themselves and their terrorist organizations to disrupting the event. In this instance, you have an individual named Doku Amarov who's committed to disrupting the games and trying to potentially kill as many of the athletes and spectators as possible. And you just don't get that in Western Europe and in competitions in the United States and other places.
Okay. Dan, with all due respect to Global Rescue and what you do, considering what you've said, don't I want Z, the company formerly known as Blackwater, to have my back this time around? Some of these, you know, former commando guys. I mean, I've seen news stories of your office, a bunch of nice looking folks at computers in Boston.
Well, that's what we show people. And, the security itself on the ground is going to be handled by more than 40,000 Russian police and military. So the physical security is, I think, well in hand by the Russians on that side. You know, for us, we employ personnel who have deep experience dealing with very difficult medical and security issues. Many of these folks, particularly for this event, do have military special operations backgrounds. So we employ SEALs and Rangers and former Special Forces personnel to perform these types of difficult missions. So if you are stuck in a place like Sochi that does happen to have an event that occurs, these are the kinds of guys that you'd want coming for you.
Okay, Blackwater's got nothing on you.
Well, you know, Blackwater had a different mission, let's just say.
Are your people already on the ground in Sochi?
They're not there presently, but they will be shortly.
You guys allowed to bring in guns, I guess?
So we don't comment on typically the tools of the trade that might get used. But in this particular instance with Russia, there are going to be plenty of guns in the hands of folks who were on the same team with the Russians themselves. So there's no need for us to do that.
Do the Russian authorities want you there? Do they welcome your presence, or are you just a nuisance for them?
I would say neither. They're not necessarily thrilled that we're going to be there, but I don't think they view us as a nuisance either. We're really enablers, and we're not going to get in the way. I think that when you're a country like Russia trying to secure these games, the more people that you have on the ground that are part of the population, that know how to deal with crises, that understand and can plan for how they might respond should a crisis occur, the better.
Dan Richards' company, Global Rescue, is under contract with the U.S. Olympic ski and snowboard teams in Sochi, Russia. Dan, wishing you and the ski and snowboard teams the best and most boring Olympics in terms of security.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. When you think of air travel, you probably think about the hassle, the lines, the ever-shrinking legroom. But at least you're likely flying on a plane that was made in the past decade or so. For people living in isolated jungle villages in Colombia, it's very different. They often fly on an American aircraft that first made its mark in World War II, the twin-engine Douglas DC-3. Reporter John Otis explains why.
In the cockpit of a DC-3, Captain John Acero and his co-pilot run through the pre-takeoff checklist. This DC-3 was built in 1944, and it shows. The compass is held in place with bungee cords. There's no autopilot. In case we go down, the survival kit includes a flare gun and a machete. Fortunately, our flight from the southern Colombian town of San Jose del Guaviare is smooth. Soon, we touch down in the jungle hamlet of Miraflores. It's a former cocaine boom town that was once controlled by Marxist guerrillas. As we exit the DC-3, its virtues become clear. The dirt airstrip at Miraflores is too short and bumpy for commercial aircraft, but the DC-3 has sturdy landing gear and balloon tires. Its slow speed allows it to put down on runways as short as 600 yards. Captain Acero has been flying DC-3s for 27 years with only a few mishaps. The tail of his plane was once hit by rebel gunfire, but he managed to bring her in safely.
Son aviones todoterreno, son los tractores del aire.
These are all-terrain airplanes, the tractors of the skies, he tells me. It doesn't matter if the runway is full of mud or water. This plane is very trustworthy and maneuverable. In the 1930s and 40s, the Douglas Aircraft Company built about 16,000 DC-3s. Back then, their speed and range helped reduce the time of coast-to-coast air travel. They transported troops during World War II and supplies during the 1949 Berlin airlift. Since then, most have been mothballed, but about a dozen DC-3s provide a lifeline for remote Colombian villages. Out here, there are few roads. In the dry season, rivers are often unnavigable, so the DC-3 is the only practical way in and out. They haul people, groceries, livestock, even small vehicles. On this flight, our DC-3 is delivering 1,000 gallons of helicopter fuel to the Colombian Army in Miraflores. As troops transfer the gas to a storage tank, passengers for the return flight rest in the shade under the wings. One of them is Francisco Nieto, a Catholic bishop. He says this vintage aircraft makes people in forgotten outposts like Miraflores feel more connected to modern Colombia. These airplanes don't just deliver food and supplies, he says. More than anything, they deliver hope. The plane can carry 20 passengers, but there are no frills like seatback trays or toilets. Seatbelts are optional. With no barrier between the pilots and passengers, some wander up to the cockpit for a look. After we land, mechanics spot brake fluid leaking from the DC-3's left wheel and replace a faulty seal. These specialists are a big reason why these 70-year-old birds are still flying. But there are only a few mechanics left in Colombia familiar with the aircraft, and spare parts are getting harder to find. Once the last DC-3 is grounded here, Captain Acero predicts hard times for places like Miraflores. The day they stop flying, it will mean hunger and poverty for these people because no other plane will fly in here, Acero says. Nothing can replace the DC-3. For The World, I'm John Otis, Miraflores, Colombia.
A massive fire has destroyed an ancient Tibetan village known as Shangri-La. The historic village, also called Dukazong, has been renamed by Chinese authorities to attract the tourists, and they'd succeeded. But now the village is mostly gone, consumed by a blaze over the weekend that lasted 10 hours and destroyed more than 200 houses. David Fundingsland leads educational tours for the group Wild China. He says Dukazong used to be a stop on the ancient Silk Road.
The town itself was an important stop on the Tea and Horse Caravan Road. So this was a caravan route where tea from the south part of Yunnan, southern China, was sent by a horse caravan into Tibet. And in exchange for the tea, they would give war horses, corals, and other valuable goods that they were getting from India and beyond. I mean, the majority of the old town, some of the old buildings probably go back 600 years. There's also a few of the old trader homes, so people who traded tea on the caravan routes, as well as many just other Tibetan homes and small temples.
This sounds like a really tragic loss of a historical place. What are you hearing from on the ground?
Well, so far, there hasn't been any official report about what the cause of the fire was. That still seems to be unknown. From what we know, the fire started around 1 a.m. in the morning, and I've heard as much as two-thirds of the old town was destroyed. There were some high winds. You know, this part of China in the winter is very dry, so and much of the homes have wood shingles on the roofs. Some of the homes and guest houses, they use wood stoves to heat in the winter, so that could very well be a cause, or just cooking stoves, etc. So they're very susceptible to fire.
Do you know if anyone's been displaced at this point?
They've relocated a number of people. As many as 2,000 people have been relocated, some to the new city in Shangri-La and others further south in a town called Lijiang.
I just want to ask you about this name or nickname of Shangri-La. Is this or was this an idyllic place?
Well, the area, how best to put this, the area has seen a lot of development in recent years, but at the same time, it's one of the most beautiful places in China. One of the most memorable experiences I had in the region was just south of Shangri-La. It's part of an old pilgrimage trail. It's only accessible by foot or by horseback, but you can hike up into the mountains, and it's quite beautiful. There's still nomadic herdsmen in the area. So during the summer months, they move out of the towns and herd their yak out in the woods and forests around Shangri-La.
Yeah, this does sound like a magical place and a real loss.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the area had already been coming under a lot of pressure for development. And so there was a lot of talk and discussion about, you know, preserving traditional values versus developing the economy versus protecting the culture. And I think this, you know, for some, maybe a bit of a game changer because, you know, it's hard to see if people will come back once this town is rebuilt, if some of the Tibetans, the local people that had been living there for a while, if they'll move on to other areas away from the old town or if they'll return.
David Fundingsland leads educational tours at Wild China, a travel company based in Beijing. Thank you for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for joining us at The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. A BBC reporter interviews a would-be child bomber in Afghanistan.
How many children do you know that can say, my brother forced me to wear a suicide vest, or that my family has connections to the Taliban, and I'm quite scared because of these connections?
No surprise that the young girl doesn't want to go back. That story ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations and communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. North Korea is a country we worry a lot about, but hardly know. We worry about its nuclear weapons and its threats against the U.S. and South Korea. And we do know that leader Kim Jong-un recently executed his own uncle. But the country itself is mostly sealed off from the outside world. Occasionally, the curtain is lifted a bit for something like a Dennis Rodman visit. But the former NBA star's trips, like everything else in North Korea, are tightly controlled by the regime. So it's almost impossible to know what it's like to live inside North Korea. You can get a glimpse, though, on PBS's Frontline tomorrow. It's airing the documentary Secret State of North Korea. James Jones is the director.
What we wanted to do really was get beyond the kind of media caricature of North Korea and its leaders. And so we teamed up with a Japanese journalist called Jiro Ishimaru, who has a network of undercover reporters, just ordinary North Koreans around the country, who film using hidden cameras, just film everyday life and capture the most extraordinary things. I mean, you've seen it, but some of the footage is just extraordinary. You know, ordinary North Koreans standing up to the authorities, for instance, is just, I mean, certainly with me, it just took my breath away.
Yeah, there are quite a few scenes, actually, where women who are being hassled by North Korean police are actually, I mean, literally fighting back, kind of slapping the cops and getting pushed around and pushing back and, you know, telling them to get lost. Any indication how typical those sorts of incidents are and, you know, why she's not hauled off to work camp somewhere?
That certainly for me was the most striking aspect of the footage. You know, the kind of poverty and the starving children is completely heartbreaking. But I guess that conforms more to our idea of North Korea. You know, we know they've had famines. We know that the majority of the population are malnourished. But actually, to see these women standing up for themselves and beating the soldier and chasing them off down the street, I think there is a change in the mindset. And, you know, I hope that's one thing that the film will achieve, is show that all North Koreans are not brainwashed. This country is as complicated as any other country, and people think for themselves, and people are cynical about their leaders.
Now, the film focuses quite a bit on Jiro, of course, but also North Koreans who have escaped to South Korea. But other than that, I found myself kind of nervous much of the time, both for those women we're talking about who are smacking the police officers, but also for these people filming. You think about civil rights campaigners in America or anywhere in Europe, you know, and as you said, they could go to jail, they could be beaten up, but these guys, they're gone. They disappear.
Yeah, and I mean, the process of deciding which footage you can use without compromising their safety is pretty laborious and elaborate. Initially, Jiro will get the footage, and he has a team of defectors in his office in Osaka, in Japan. And so I went to Osaka and went through some of this footage with them. And they will tell you you can't use the most unexpected thing because it will identify the street or the market that's near to this guy's home, for instance. So a lot of care goes into that.
Are there any lessons from what you learned while making this film about how the international community should deal with North Korea? More pressure, less pressure? I don't know.
The interesting thing for me was that everyone, whether it was kind of American policymakers, South Koreans, or North Korean defectors, what's immediately clear is the sanctions don't work. You know, the pressure put on them in that sense by the international community is impotent. It has no effect because Kim Jong-un can keep the 1% elite in Pyongyang happy by importing luxury goods from China. And he doesn't really care if the 99% eat grass for 100 years. Change is going to come from people like Mr. Chung, who takes huge risks smuggling American movies, South Korean soap operas on DVDs and thumb drives back into North Korea. And these are then passed around the markets and watched by huge numbers of North Koreans now who are kind of desperate to see the outside world. And that is having far more effect than any kind of international policy, because it's breaking the spell of the regime's propaganda.
There's a scene of a couple girls watching one of these television shows on their computer from one of these thumb drives, and the picture is just a sort of banal nature tour, and you hear them say, wow, I'd love to live in a country like that someday. Must be Europe or somewhere. We don't know where it is, but it's obviously not North Korea.
Yeah, and it's exactly that kind of thing that just makes people think, you know, these are tall buildings, people are driving cars, people are eating meat. You know, it just undermines everything they've been told by the North Korean state media. So it's, you know, it's incredibly powerful. And, you know, you wouldn't think that some kind of trashy movie would have such a kind of profound effect, but it really does seem that is the case.
James Jones' documentary, Secret State of North Korea, airs tomorrow night on the PBS program Frontline. James Jones, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Last week, we reported on a young girl who was detained by police in Afghanistan after what was described as a failed suicide bomb attack against a police checkpoint. The girl, whose name is Spojmai, said it was her brother who tried to get her to do it. Today, Spojmai is still in custody, and she doesn't want to go back to her family. But she did speak with the BBC's Shaima Khalil.
Well, I think the first thing that struck me about her, Aaron, was how incredibly young she was. She's 9 years old. And you know, the first question I had really in my head was, how on earth could someone that young get their hands on a suicide vest, let alone understand what it's for or actually go out and do something with it? So I started by asking Spojmai how she came to wear the suicide vest.
It was night, and the mullah was calling for prayers. And my brother took me outside and told me to put on this vest. And he showed me how to operate it. And I say, I can't. What if the zip doesn't work? And he said, it will, don't worry. He took the vest back from me and he hit me hard. And I felt a fear. And then he left me near the checkpoint where he said I had to operate this vest.
Shaima Khalil, it's just a harrowing story, isn't it?
Absolutely.
What kind of family life did she have before this?
Not a very good one, I must say, because when she told me how she was forced by her brother to wear this and then he beat her when she didn't, she then told me that he took her to this checkpoint and just left her there. She slept overnight and was found by one of the guards at the checkpoint and taken by the authorities. She said that her family life is extremely difficult. She doesn't have a mother, and her stepmother doesn't treat her very, very well. But she also went on to tell me about her family's attitude towards her and her education.
I didn't go to school because nobody let me to go to school. I can't read a word. And my brother told me that you're here in this world and you will die. You're not here to learn or to do other things. You're here just to do the duty.
Now, Spojmai seems incredibly articulate for a girl who's 9 or 10. Is that true? Just a translation thing?
No, even from her tone, you could feel and understand how assertive she is and how assertive she must have had to be, really, through her life. She sounded to me, unfortunately, like many young girls that I've met that are young children that have to do the work of adults. She was expected to do everything in the house, to cook and clean. And as you have heard, she's never gone to school. How many children do you know that can say, my brother forced me to wear a suicide vest, or that my family has connections to the Taliban and I'm quite scared because of these connections? So it told me the way that she spoke of a child that didn't really have a childhood. Also, the authorities that are keeping her now said that there is a possibility that she might be sent home, that they're trying to mediate between the family and the tribal elders to get a reassurance. So I put this possibility to her. I said, well, how do you feel about going back home?
Even if the government says that they will guarantee my safety, I'm not going back there. The same thing will happen again. They have told me before, if you don't do it this time, we will make you do it again. And my father is here. He came here and he told me to come back. And I said, no, I will kill myself rather than go with you.
It just seems impossible, Shaima Khalil, that authorities would send her back to this house.
Well, that's what they're saying could happen. But also you have to remember that in this part of Afghanistan, Helmand, it's extremely, extremely conservative and traditional and tribal. And for the authorities to just keep a hold of a young girl without her family's consent is very abnormal. It just doesn't happen. I mean, it's quite tragic to hear a small child say, I'd rather kill myself than go back home. But this is really why her future is in limbo.
Now, is there any way of knowing how, I don't know how to say this, how normal this sort of situation is with young girls forced into family situations like this?
I think it's not unique, girls that live in extremely difficult family circumstances. Definitely not unique to Afghanistan. I mean, she did appeal to Hamid Karzai to put her in a good place, and whether they'll take her on and follow her case up and make sure that nothing happens to her, unfortunately, it will be up to the authorities to make sure whether or not she's safe and whether or not she's put in a safe place.
The BBC's Shaima Khalil, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Good to speak to you, Aaron.
Iran and the West have now agreed on a date when the nuclear deal they reached back in November takes effect. And that date, as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told reporters, is January 20th.
As of that day, January 20th, for the first time in almost a decade, Iran's nuclear program will not be able to advance. In fact, parts of it will be rolled back.
The deal calls for Iran to stop production of highly enriched uranium and the building of any new centrifuges. In return, the U.S. and European countries will begin to ease some of the economic sanctions imposed on Iran. It's an interim deal, pending a more long-term agreement. Here's how David Albright describes it. He's president of the Institute for Science and International Security in Washington.
The most important part of the deal is that it's buying some time. It's in a sense, freezing the most threatening parts of Iran's nuclear program and allowing time for the United States and its allies to, in the P5+1 in Germany, to try to negotiate a long-term deal. Now, in practical terms, Iran doesn't get very much for this deal in the agreement. I mean, it gets some sanctions relief, gets some, in essence, some money released from frozen accounts. There's a part of it, though, that Iran's hoping to get, which is to weaken the sanctions regime. But the United States and others are going to try to stop that. So I think in practical terms, what's in the agreement is Iran doesn't get much sanctions relief.
David Albright, that sounds diametrically opposite from what Congress was complaining about a few weeks ago.
Congress worries about that Iran will exploit the situation to weaken the sanctions. Remember, there's some members of Congress who don't think the deal is good at all. And I personally think there's a lot of advantages to having this interim deal and then the opportunity to negotiate a comprehensive solution. Some members of Congress don't want to see a centrifuge program or any significant nuclear programs at all in Iran at the end of the negotiation process. The joint plan of action is not going to provide that.
Tell me, David, exactly what Iran is giving up in this deal.
Well, there's several things it's giving up. One, there's certain conditions that it's accepting on its nuclear program, and there's additional monitoring or verification activities by the International Atomic Energy Agency that'll provide more transparency of the nuclear program. Iran is giving up its making of near 20% enriched uranium, which is not that far from being 90% enriched. And that's the enrichment level you'd want for nuclear weapons. Iran is going to start converting some of its 3.5% enriched uranium out of the hexafluoride form into an oxide form. And what that means is that it wouldn't be readily usable in the centrifuge process to further enrich to 20% and then on to 90%. So it's in a sense, you measure Iranian progress by its ability to break out and make enough weapon-grade uranium, the 90% material, for nuclear weapons. And the breakout times will increase as a result of this interim deal.
Are you confident that all the verification mechanisms are in place and that Iran will act upon what it has promised?
I think Iran is going to be difficult. I mean, it showed during the negotiations of the implementation of the interim deal. There's a lot of words in that, but the joint plan of action set up an interim deal. It had language defining it. Iran caused a lot of trouble in the negotiations about what does that language mean? What does broken mean? Well, broken to us would mean it doesn't work anymore. Didn't necessarily mean that to Iran. The main action, though, is going to be in two places. One is, can you arrive at a comprehensive solution? If Iran says it should, whatever conditions are imposed only have a duration of 3.5 years, the U.S. says 20 years, can they narrow the difference?
David Albright is founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security in Washington, D.C. Thank you, David, for your time.
Okay, thank you.
For the latest from the world's newsroom, follow us on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. And check out what I'm seeing and thinking about. Don't worry, it's not as strange as you might think. I'm at World Aaron. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. 100 years ago, West Flanders was one of the most militarized zones on Earth. That's where part of the famous Western Front of the First World War passed, and it is there that many of the heavier battles were fought. Now, with the centenary beginning in 2014, the region is launching a 4-year commemoration of the Great War and readying itself to reap the benefits of a projected bump in tourist numbers. Don Duncan sent us this report from Ypres, the Flemish city at the center of it all.
Almost every evening in Ypres since 1928, come rain or shine, a group of buglers has appeared beneath the Menin Gate monument to honor the fallen soldiers of World War I.
Quite often you'll choke up and cry when you hear that, the bugles.
New Zealander Maria Sainsbury is among a crowd of only about 30. But as the year goes on, and for the next 4 years, Belgium expects numbers flocking to their World War I sites to grow by 50%. That's a total of 2 million tourists. Leo Winkler is World War I project manager at the Flemish government's Visit Flanders office. The Flemish government has poured some $40 million into expanding museums and exhibitions, increasing parking, and an international PR blitz.
It's an event that links our very small region in Flanders to the rest of the world, because there were 50 countries from nowadays who have people who have been fighting and dying here.
Private businesses are scrambling to make the most of the army of expected tourists. Jean Wintz, CEO of Brussels City Tours, takes me on a once-off private trip.
The front line in Belgium was roughly 60 kilometers. On that stretch of territory were roughly 500,000 people killed.
Wintz has created this special tour of World War I sites, which leaves from Brussels twice weekly. We visit cemeteries for soldiers fighting for the British Army. We visit German cemeteries, monuments erected by various countries after the war, the remains of trenches, bunkers, field hospitals. Hotels all across Flanders are getting ready also.
Here will come two new rooms.
Yeah.
So you can, go in.
Yeah. Christiane de Kramer Pride opened the Albion Hotel, a small family-run business in 2000. Now she's building 9 new rooms, a conference area, and adding 28 parking spaces. Her reservations book is already filling up.
In April and May and July and September, we have a lot of periods who are fully booked. It's a very good start also.
But the government wants to ensure that this very good start doesn't get out of hand.
For us, it's very important to communicate in a very respectful manner.
That's Stephen Ledewijk of West Tour, the tourist authority of the West Flanders region. The market is awash with tacky trinkets, T-shirts, and other commemorative items that flirt with the limits of good taste. This is a battle site, after all. So, West Tour is trying to get local businesses to attend workshops on how to respectfully commemorate the Great War.
We told them about the history of World War I, about what is going to happen in the next 4 or 5 years. And we instructed them to establish serene communication.
One successful example of serene communication, they say, may be coming to a pub near you. Passchendaele beer is a new brew developed to commemorate the Battle of Passchendaele in 1917, which saw almost 500,000 casualties. The beer is made by the Van Honsebroek Brewery in West Flanders. Jean-Christophe Faes is the company's marketing manager.
It's a commercial product, but we also, together with that beer, we want to bring it to the people to commemorate the big war. It's a very thin line to walk.
Between 2014 and 18, Flanders at large will have to walk that thin line between the commemoration of a dark period of its history and making the most of an unprecedented tourist boom. All that remains is for those tourists to show up. For the world, I'm Don Duncan in Ypres, Belgium.
Tourists planning to visit the battlefields of World War I probably have some idea of what that war was like. The conventional image is of mud and trenches and generals sending men to die in waves. Some would even characterize those generals as lazy and clueless, which is the sort of image presented in the comedy series Blackadder Goes Forth.
Name?
Baldrake, sir.
Go tally-ho, yibbity-dap and zing-zang spillet. Are you looking forward to the big push?
No, sir, I'm absolutely terrified.
The healthy humour of the honest Tommy. Don't worry, my boy. If you should falter, remember that Captain Darling and I are behind you.
About 35 miles behind.
It seems the British government is unhappy with that image and is even calling it a myth. In fact, Britain's Education Secretary Michael Gove has gone so far as to tell teachers to stop using Blackadder as a teaching aid. It seems like a natural question for our resident history buff and Blackadder fan, Chris Wolfe. First of all, Chris, what is wrong with Blackadder?
Blackadder follows the adventures through time of this rather asinine character, rather acerbic, offensive gentleman who has various adventures in different time periods. One of the series is set in World War One, and it shows this officer who is desperately aware of the next time he goes into an attack, he's going to be killed and he's going to die uselessly, as is everyone around him. And it's his efforts to try and avoid going into the attack. And it's this idea that the government's trying to avoid, that the troops were demoralized, that the generals were incompetent, and every attack was completely useless.
So is Blackadder right or wrong?
I think it's just a question of degree. I think if you look at the near mutinies that happened in the troops and the constant repetitive failure of the generals to kind of overcome the strength of the defensive fortifications they had encountered in World War One, I think it's like a good legend. It has many grains of truth, and they're somewhat exaggerated. And I think overall, though, those grains of truth are pretty strong.
The world's history guy, Chris Wolfe, thank you. And let's go out with a bit more Blackadder as the men finally get ready to go over the top.
I have a plan, sir.
Really, Baldrick? A cunning and subtle one?
Yes, sir.
As cunning as a fox who's just been appointed Professor of Cunning at Oxford University?
Yes, sir.
On the signal, company will advance.
Well, I'm afraid it'll have to wait. Whatever it was, I'm sure it was better than my plan to get out of this by pretending to be mad. I mean, who would have noticed another madman around here? Good luck, everyone.
And from the Nan and Bill Harris studios, I'm Aaron Schachter. Marco Werman's back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.